And so, walking through the Bible's dark forest, he starts off by saying, many Christian philosophers and theologians are quick to shield God's providence from evil, supposing that he might become contaminated by exposure to it. This is kind of a lofty goal and idea. This is, no one's really wants to say, you know, God's this kind of demiurge who throws rocks down from on high from Mount Olympus, and and you know he's just a mean god during the day, but then he's satiated by sacrifices or soothing songs or what may be. But no, they try to say that evil is this other thing than God, and he can't be the author or the source from which it came. But the God of the Bible shows no such concern. He gladly declares both his full control over and his intricate plans for the same evil he hates with a holy hatred, and thus condemns in no uncertain terms. And that's pretty clear throughout the Bible of hating sin. Sin is this thing that's opposite of what God has commanded or who God is or what he wants. And this paradoxical feature of the biblical witness, God's holy sovereignty walking alongside repulsive wickedness, is foundational for grasping a scriptural theodicy. Mm. It's one of the reasons why the Bible doesn't end after chapter 3. And he's grounding it, not that this surprised God or came about that was a plan B type deal, but this was part of his plan, and he still walks alongside fallen creatures that he then wrests control from the devil and puts it square. He adopts those people squarely into his family, mm-hmm. and even those that he doesn't adopt, he uses that evil and those people for his good pleasure and for the greater good.
Exactly. Yeah. And so Christensen tells us, and he kind of indicates the problem here. How can God decree and ensure in his meticulous providence, right, the happening of things that he otherwise vehemently opposes, right? And so he says he wants to show this tension and this paradox are clearly displayed in the teaching of Scripture. And this leaves theologians with a dilemma. It has resulted in two fundamental but opposing visions concerning God, man, and evil. One vision, he says, is to downplay or reinterpret the biblical data. Remember, we don't want God to be evil or to right. be associated with evil, right? So it seeks to exonerate God at all costs, putting forth a picture of reality in which his providence, right, his control over his creation is curtailed in one degree or another, he tells us, at the expense of granting humanity an unwarranted level of autonomy. We are free. That's why, God is exempt from evil, because it's our fault we do it. We got him out of the pot, right? you know, and so that's, so that's one way that he suggests that they try to overcome this particular issue, because if God is in control, if he has sovereign decrees, then somehow, he's responsible for evil. And of course, folks don't want that, and therefore, they say, well, no, it's human free will, right? And as we have seen, he's already suggested that doesn't work.
Right. And we can kind of see an example of this debate going on, because we kind of covered previously, a couple chapters ago, Molinism, and at the recording of this, but you're probably watching about a month after it, on the Unbelievable broadcast, James White, who's a Calvinist and Reformed person, kind of had a debate discussion with William Lane Craig, who's a Molinist, and the topic of discussion was which kind of version of Christianity does the best to explain the problem of evil. That's what it was kind of grounded on. So I'll link that video below, but I'm sure we've all probably seen it by now. I'm projecting a month into the future, so it was a rare discussion on William Lane Craig's part to kind of interact with somebody else and not just ideas and concepts that he kind of puts forth. But I thought that was a good interaction, especially in light of what Christensen has covered here. So we've already explored the opposing vision, which sees God in his unbridled glory. It is decidedly theocentric, that is like God-centered. This is the God as explicated in the classical and Reformed tradition, the God of Augustine, Anselm, Calvin, Luther, Owen Edwards, especially Warfield, Sproul, and J.I. Packer. It is reflected in the greater good brands of theodicy. Humanity's role is not denigrated here. It is shown to give way to a God of a far grander and more all-encompassing nature than many of his timid apologists are want to afford to him. So, you know, we have people that don't seem to have a problem with evil in this capacity.
Yeah, yeah, and associating it somehow, you know, with God without tainting God and calling God evil.
Yeah, none of those people are going to say, "Well, yeah, God, you know, he's just a little bit evil to let evil in, or he's the author of evil."
Yeah, no. And so the first major area in this particular chapter he wants us to see is God's absolute goodness, right? So even though we can, there's going to be some association, he wants to first to establish the fact that God is absolutely good, right? Mm-hmm. Before he says we can adequately consider God's sovereign relationship to evil, it's important to affirm the doctrine of his absolute goodness. He says that all Orthodox Christians agree on the general outlines of how to construe God's goodness, right? Nonetheless, he says we must see that God's goodness and his power has the sovereign necessity to go together, right? They must never in any circumstances be separated. God's sovereignty never trumps his goodness, right? As some accuse Calvinism of teaching, he says. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, God's goodness never trumps his sovereignty, right? We're talking about one God with one nature, and so, you know, he isn't out of balance, as it were, right?
So this is kind of like the idea of divine simplicity. It's not this kind of, if you try and take the root word, it's like, oh, well, God is a simple being to understand. No, he's not a collection of parts. It's not, here's his loving side and here's his non-loving side. God is not made up of parts. He is all love and all mercy and all glory, and he's all these things and not divisible by it. And mm-hmm. he expresses them both equally and in perfect relationship with every other characteristics of him. So that's what if you've heard divine simplicity argued before, that's what is being talked about here. So many free will theists emphasize God's love and goodness as the controlling paradigm for solving the problem of evil. But the unity and simplicity of God's being mean that we cannot single out one of his attributes and place it above another, or we, you know, kind of topple over the normal orthodox understanding of who God is and how he's related to in Scripture, which, again, our ultimate authority is what we're trying to derive our theodicy from. Mm-hmm. All the attributes are equally God's being. In him, there is no higher and lower, no greater and smaller. The God of mercy is equally the God of justice. The God of love is equally the God of wrath. Wrath cannot be understood apart from God's love, and vice versa.
Right. And so, you know, he has some proof text, right? David declares, "O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him." Psalm 34:8. Mm-hmm. He says, in this regard, God's goodness is simply his benevolence, right? God does that which is to the benefit of his creation. He is the source of all natural, moral, spiritual good. Nothing impedes his abundant goodness, as Psalm 145 says, right?
So God's goodness is also closely connected to his holiness, especially as that rich term refers to his distinctly exalted moral purity. God is wholly righteous and free of any taint of evil or of any moral defilement. Thus, it is impossible for him to entertain an evil thought or intention. There is no possible scenario in which God could contemplate an evil thought. He doesn't stumble into it and say, I got a little hot-headed here. Yeah. Let me back off. I apologize. I'm sorry.
Oops, I missed this one.
Right, yeah. He hits 100% of the shots he takes. So he doesn't contemplate this evil thought or utter an evil word or commit an evil deed. Job 34:10 says, "Hear me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God that he should do wickedness, and from the Almighty that he should do wrong." It's not possible. The character and nature that God is made up of, as revealed in Scripture, it's like putting dirt on a gloved hand. It just doesn't get on you.
Right.
It's
right.
not possible.
Exactly. And so God's righteousness then means that he demands obedience of his image-bearing creatures. Every human being is under a divine mandate, obligated to abide by the moral law that God has inscribed in our hearts. Romans chapter 2 talks about that, right? We have the law written on our hearts. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, the demands of an impeccably righteous God also indicates that he is a wholly just, right? He's fair. He's just. He rewards righteousness equitably and punishes all wickedness impartially, right? So he's righteous, he's holy, he's just, and that's part of who God is, right?
Right. When we say that, well, we want God to be fair, we don't want God to be fair. That's what we don't want. But he is perfectly fair within being perfect with his divine justice and also being a merciful God. Since all have sinned and fall short of the glory of his moral perfection, as Romans 3:23 says, each person faces one of two destinies. Some will be justified by his grace through the redemption of his son, as Romans 3:24 says, and the fullness of joy that proceeds from God's presence and goodness in their inheritance forever, Psalm 16:11 says, while others will face the terrifying prospect of having to suffer the punishment of eternal destruction away from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his might. They kind of lose this general divine common grace that is afforded to all people, and they're essentially given over to themselves to enact whatever they want in this outer darkness. Yeah. That's Second Thessalonians 1:9.
And so they'll suffer this punishment.
Yeah. And again, we don't take our theology from Dante. Dante was you know, a Roman Catholic, and so we have issues with that. But you know, he's writing in poetical form there too. And we definitely don't take it from Looney Tunes cartoons, if there's still Looney Tunes cartoons around. But back in my day, you know, you had whatever version of Tom and Jerry or Bugs Bunny, with the pitchforks and getting one over and all the little hellfires and stuff. You know, the that's not where we derive our idea from this eternal destruction, this outer darkness. Because of their disbelief, they're cast into this separation from this chasm which cannot be crossed. It's a dishonor to him and their unrepentant rebellion against God.
Right. And I think we saw that in the last chapter. He mentions that, you know, this idea that, you know, what should happen is, in terms of punishment, if we punish God one time, then maybe we should only be, I mean, if we go against God one time, then we should only be punished one time. The problem with that is God is infinite, right? And so when we go against God, when we sin against God, when we do evil, then we have offended an infinite God who has to exercise infinite justice. Mm-hmm. And so it's no, well, you know, 3 years in hell and then I'm out kind of thing. Right? Yeah. No. We have offended and gone against and rebelled against an infinite God, and we owe an infinite penalty. I mean, and we do the same thing in our own system of justice, right? Mm-hmm. And I think I used this illustration last time. If I tell a lie to you, you know, you might get mad, but so what? But if I tell that same lie to a police officer, that he can do something about it. And if I tell that same lie to a grand jury, now I'm in big trouble, mm-hmm. right? Because the higher the authority, the greater the penalty. And we see the same thing here, right? God is the ultimate authority. And so when we, even the same thing against God, it deserves the ultimate penalty, right? And so, you know, we can't just say, oh, well, you know, I wasn't good. That bad.
Right, yeah.